From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. 30 years have passed since the U.S. Education Secretary offered a new theory. He said federal student aid helps drive up the cost of college tuition. Now, a North Carolina-based higher education watchdog group puts that idea to the test. Speaking of higher education, the UNC system recently engaged in a six-figure rebranding campaign. You'll learn why. The next federal farm bill is bound to feature some dubious pieces that have nothing to do with helping struggling farmers. You'll hear an expert's assessment. And we'll look at the slate of candidates for North Carolina's 2018 legislative elections. Who's running where? Those topics are just ahead. But first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
One of our regular guests on this program is Rick Henderson, who is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Now, usually Rick joins us to talk about Carolina Journal's reporting on a particular issue or a challenge that faces North Carolina policymakers and taxpayers. But this week, it's a little bit different. Rick joins us to accept congratulations for his team, and we'll talk about some stories as well. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
Congratulations in order to you and the reporting team, specifically Carrie Travis of Carolina Journal, for winning some awards from the North Carolina Press Association. That's awesome.
Yeah, that was very exciting for us. We're really pleased. It's the first year that we've entered the competition in our 27 years of publication, and we were delighted to be honored. It was a great evening for us to do that because it's the sort of thing. We could not have entered this competition more than about a half dozen years ago because there wasn't really a place for us to be. And now that we have that opportunity and we were confident enough in our work to place the entries, we were just really delighted to be recognized.
Let's talk about some of the award-winning work from Carolina Journal, which, by the way, you can find this series at carolinajournal.com. Rick, you yourself received an award for editorial writing. Now, this was a series of editorials that you wrote related to the General Assembly session. Tell us about the pieces.
What I wanted to do was find some of the columns that I'd written over the previous year that dealt with some issues that had not been getting a lot of coverage in the traditional press or in the mainstream press. And so I packaged them as sort of underappreciated stories from the recent legislative session. So that included editorials about the fact that we had gotten through another budget cycle without any serious drama, that they'd actually been able to cut taxes and increase savings and still get some spending increases in there as well. And that really didn't get a lot of attention in the other press. And so that was one of the stories. Another one had to do with the absence of unaffiliated members of the State Board of Elections. Now, that subsequently may change depending on what the law does. But there were Democrats who were complaining that although unaffiliated voters are becoming or had become the second highest category or classification of voters in North Carolina, they had no representation on the State Board of Elections. And my basic point was there was no way to do that because the General Assembly hadn't allocated a slot for unaffiliated candidates. And besides that, there's not an unaffiliated party of North Carolina. I mean, there's not an independent party as such on the ballot. And so there are sort of issues that I discussed that may not have gotten much attention. And the president of the Press Association sent me a personal note saying that he read all the entries. And he thought that my editorials really were stellar. So I was glad to see that.
Yeah, Rick, what I think is really important for our listeners to understand about you winning this award is not only is it just terrific that, you know, you've won the award and that Carolina Journal has been honored in this category for editorial writing, but it really speaks to the niche that Carolina Journal really fills in terms of covering things that other media members, newspapers, radio, television don't cover.
Right. That's right. We don't try to be and don't pretend to be the newspaper of record, the thing that you have to pick up if you want to know everything that's going on in state government in North Carolina. But we want to cover issues that we think are very important to our audience and that should be covered. And so that's why we will deal with education policy from perhaps a different perspective than other places. We might talk more about property rights or open government transparency issues and things like that. And so we're not going to try to cover every legislative hearing, but we're going to try to make sure that issues that are relevant to limited government and individual freedom get coverage that may not otherwise get paid attention to by the other media outlets in the state.
Let's talk about the two other awards. This time, both of them won by Associate Editor Carrie Travis, an up-and-coming journalist in this area. I'm really proud to have her working here at Carolina Journal. Let's talk first about her series on juvenile justice reform, mm-hmm. Raise the Age specifically. What was that about, Rick?
Those were about efforts in the General Assembly to change the way that young offenders are prosecuted and handled by the justice system. North Carolina wound up being the last state in the nation that still treated people who were younger than 18 as adults in many cases. And this process raised the age of prosecution in the juvenile system from 16 to 18. And so what it simply did was phased in this process so that people who were younger than 18, many of them males, were not just simply warehoused in the adult system but were handled by juvenile courts, in which typically they get more counseling. There's a much more rehabilitative effort to handle these young people and to give them opportunities to, once they have paid their debt to society, to actually reintegrate in a normal society and not just simply being dumped out, as they say, dumped out in the Walmart parking lot and be left on their own.
This had become an issue for state lawmakers because they were looking at research that was showing that reform of this kind in other states had really had some sort of an impact or correlation mm-hmm. with recidivism. And of course, right. The goal of any system would be to, if someone's going to be back out in society, you want them to become productive, law-abiding members of society. You don't want them to reoffend.
Right. And we had just been laggards in that issue. And people, the John Locke Foundation, had made a big effort in the regards of research and to talk about the fact that other states had great success. And then the main issue at that point then was convincing members of the General Assembly and the public at large that it was worth the additional expense to move these categories of offenses from adult offenses to juvenile offenses for older offenders. And to point out, if you will, that the initial investment, because it requires an initial investment not only in different sorts of facilities, but also an investment in more people to serve as counselors and to serve as mentors, sometimes to serve as judges, and to actually adjudicate these cases, that upfront cost was worthwhile. And we were very happy to see that that had an impact, because it's one thing when the American Civil Liberties Union or some group that's normally associated with the left comes out and says we need to handle criminal offenders differently if they're basically engaged in nonviolent offenses. But it's another thing entirely for a group that's more affiliated or aligned with conservative to say the same thing.
Rick, Carrie Travis's second award for reporting came for a series of pieces she wrote about a really terrible problem in North Carolina and other states, and that is human trafficking.
Right. She won that award, and we're very happy again about that recognition and acknowledgement, because the most people have associated the issue of human trafficking with immigration and illegal immigration, and what you would hear about the van load of 20 Salvadoran immigrants who were being used essentially brought across the border to serve as cheap labor or day labor for different facilities, different construction sites, that sort of thing. She focused on the sex trade and the fact that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of victims, that North Carolina is one of the real hotbeds nationally for the sex trade and for mostly women who are abducted against their will, or who quite often are becoming involved in abusive relationships and then are used for prostitution, for drug trafficking, for other sorts of purposes. And she did a very good job of actually finding organizations that were trying to help these women and pointing out the fact that that had a big impression on the legislature, that there's the problem is that you can rescue these women from this life, but then what happens? This is sort of like the juvenile offender issue. Then what do you do? How do you provide them with education and training? How do you give them a place to live? What sorts of things happen? And right now, state law did not allow state funding to go to an awful lot of these nonprofit organizations. And so this is something the General Assembly is still dealing with. But we raised the attention on it, and she got an incredible amount of compliments from the members of the General Assembly about that.
If you would like to read these award-winning stories from Carolina Journal's Rick Henderson and Carrie Travis, they are online where they were published at carolinajournal.com. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Rick, thank you very much. Congratulations to you and your team.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at carolinajournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. 30 years have passed since the U.S. Education Secretary offered what came to be known as the Bennett Hypothesis. It deals with the link between college tuition and student aid from the federal government. Our next guest recently asked, does the Bennett Hypothesis still matter? Jenna Robinson is president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. Welcome back, Jenna.
It's great to be here, Mitch.
So first of all, before we get into whether it still matters, remind us, what was the Bennett hypothesis and who was Bennett?
So Bill Bennett was the education secretary for President Ronald Reagan, and he offered his hypothesis in an op-ed in the New York Times in 1987. And at the time, there weren't a lot of data available about what was going on because student loans had only really ramped up in the late 70s. But what he said was that the availability of federal money gave universities the opportunity to raise tuition. He didn't say necessarily, you know, it's directly causing them to raise tuition, but it certainly gave them the opportunity to do what they wanted to do anyway, which was collect more money. And it's pretty intuitive that if a university knows that students have more money available to them, that they're able to raise their tuition to, you know, what they want it to be in order to pay for football fields or, you know, rock star professors, you know, new student unions or what have you.
And that was a prediction that was made back in 1987, fairly
right.
Early on into this process. Now, 30 plus years later, you asked in a column for the Martin Center, does that Bennett hypothesis still matter? And what was your answer?
Yes, it does. I mean, we know that since 1978, when universities' student tuition and fees had their own CPI, we know that since then, tuition has gone up. Tuition and fees have gone up about 1,500%. Now, the consumer price index in general, you know, I can't remember it offhand, but somewhere around 300%. So it's you know, magnitudes different. It's more than healthcare. It's more than new construction. Which I think when people hear that, they think, well, gosh, we had a bubble in construction. What's going on with student loans? And so when a lot of scholars over the past 30 years started examining his hypothesis and testing it, which that's what you do, right? You test the hypothesis. Does it work? A majority found that, yes, there is a connection between the availability of federal money and student loans. They found different degrees of what you know, what that relationship was. And like I said, it's a majority. It wasn't all of them. Some of them found, you know, there wasn't a relationship. But I think that when you take the evidence as a whole, you say, yes, I think Bennett had the right idea.
That is the voice of Jenna Robinson. She is president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. Jenna, some people might be listening to us and thinking, okay, well, you know, the colleges get to raise the tuition, but there's more student loan money, so students can get these loans. What's the problem here? Why is this a problem?
The problem is that students cannot pay them back. Students are, you know, not able to get jobs that are commensurate with the amount of loans that they have taken out. And this is for a variety of reasons. More students are going to school without a real idea of what they want to study, what they want to accomplish. They're going to school without the preparedness that they need to really succeed in college. And so there are a good number of students who are either dropping out without ever finishing a degree, and those students, of course, have a terrible time trying to pay off their loans. Those students default at very high numbers. And then there are other students who do graduate with a degree but then are underemployed. And so for a variety of reasons, students can't pay back these loans. And it has effects kind of further in the economy because of that.
In addition to creating problems for the students, it also sounds as if this would set up a situation in which there's no fiscal discipline for the universities to keep a lid on tuition. If you say to yourself, okay, we're going to raise tuition, but the students are going to be able to take out money to pay for it, there's no incentive to say we should keep tuition as low as possible.
Absolutely. I mean, the one place where we do see an incentive to keep a lid on tuition is with public universities and community colleges. Their increases have been a lot more modest compared to private universities. And that is because, of course, the public is a watchdog for all of these public universities. The taxpayers are a watchdog for that. And so there is a point at which taxpayers will say, look, we're paying for this. This is a public university. Why are you also charging this immense tuition? And so there is some incentive there, and I think that's a good thing that people are watching out on that end. But you're right that private universities, especially elite private universities, have been able to raise their tuition kind of really without any limitations.
Looking at this, this is something that was identified as a potential problem at least 30 years ago. Now, from what you're saying, we see that it is a problem. Mm-hmm. Is there any sign that other than this the public watchdog attempt to limit the increases, that anything is going to be done to change the system?
You know, I think the biggest indicator that we're going to see a change is that we've finally started seeing public awareness change. And so we see that fewer students, by a really small margin, are choosing to go to post-secondary education. And I think that that's an indicator that we have finally hit up on a ceiling for this. And so, you know, for years and years, the percentage of high school graduates who went on to college increased year over year over year. We finally got to about 70% of all high school graduates went on to college. And then it took a tiny dip, and we've stayed in the high 60s for almost a decade now. And so I think that's an indicator that no more tuition increases, no more enrollment increases are really going to be tolerated by the public. And so because of that, and I think just because we've seen really the skyrocketing tuition and have really good measures of it, you start to see in the media people talking about, well, maybe apprenticeships are a better idea. Maybe trade schools are a better idea. Maybe college isn't paying back what it promised. And so I think that there has been a public awakening on this issue. And I think that in order to get any meaningful policy change, that public awareness is really key.
From your vantage point, is this a good thing that people are starting to take a look at this and look at alternatives to the sort of college for all ideal?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that an academic route doesn't serve all students. There need to be students who go to vocational education, students who go to apprenticeships or the military, students who take a little bit of time off to work and then decide what they really want to do. Because I think there are way too many students who go to get what they probably think of as just a generic college degree. You know, a degree that they don't really have in mind how they're going to use it or what they're going to do or what their plans are. Getting a little bit more invested in the purpose of higher education is a great thing for students.
The title of that column, Does the Bennett Hypothesis Still Matter? The author, Jenna Robinson, president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. And if people would like to read this column and other items that you've written about, where can they find them?
They can find it at jamesgmartin.center.
All right, Jenna Robinson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The University of North Carolina system recently spent $250,000 for a new logo and brand. Why? President Margaret Spellings explained during a news conference unveiling the logo. It features a dark blue map of the state with a white star and yellow letters N and C.
When I first arrived in North Carolina, I heard a lot of people talking about how this was the best kept secret in the state and so on. But I was heartened when the bond passed by such a wide margin, and I knew, and I think we all know, that North Carolinians love this university. They love the university and their community, but they also appreciate the power and the mighty engine that is the University of North Carolina system. We're in a day and time when 70% of the jobs require post-secondary education. The people of North Carolina have what we offer and need what we offer. And we are a big part of the success and prosperity of North Carolina and why we're a growing and thriving state. This new unified platform and brand gives us the opportunity, I think, to talk about the system as an entity itself. Why are we doing this now? This is a time when I think people are often rightly skeptical about higher education, including public higher education. They see prices go up. They see debt levels high. They wonder about the value proposition, and that's why it's important that we do a much better job of telling our story, how higher education is indisputably a part of the future of this state and, of course, each of us as individuals. So we have this paradox that at the time when higher education is most needed, people are increasingly skeptical, and that's why it's important that we talk about what we do in more powerful ways. Our mission today and beyond is going to continue to talk about what this university is and means, how we need to do something we've never done before in American higher education, and that is educate, you know, darn near everybody to much higher levels in very affordable ways. And we aim to do that. We will do that. We will close the rural-urban divide. We will meet the needs of the economy and the workforce, especially in the STEM fields that are so prominent here in this state. We will address issues of affordability. We are addressing issues of affordability, and we are mighty and important.
That's UNC System President Margaret Spellings. She's offering details about the university's recent $250,000 branding campaign. It includes a new logo for the university system as a whole. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. As Congress prepares to address the next federal farm bill, our next guest is drawing attention to one particular piece of the legislation. It amounts to a $15 billion a year safety net for farmers. Darren Baxt is research fellow in agricultural policy at the Heritage Foundation. Welcome back, Darren.
Thanks, Mitch. Great to be here.
And I'm saying welcome back because many listeners of this program might remember that Darren Baxt was a longtime legal and regulatory policy analyst and director of legal and regulatory issues for the John Locke Foundation.
So yeah, we appreciate great years.
You, appreciate you being back with us on this very interesting topic. So the federal farm bill is a very large piece of legislation, lots of pieces, but the piece that you're focusing on is what is thought of as sort of a safety net for farmers. Why should we be focusing on this?
Well, real quickly, I think when people the safety net is really what people think of when they think of the farm bill. Really, most of it is food stamps, at least the cost of it. The farm bill costs around, I don't know, $90 to $100 billion a year. So this safety net component is really what people think of when you kind of hand out to farmers to help them allegedly to assist with risk. And, you know, that costs about $15 to $20 billion a year. My big concern with the safety net is that I think people think that if I ask somebody walking down the street, what is the safety net for farmers? When do we help them? They would think, oh, when there's a big storm, there's a drought, there's big crop losses. Well, if only that was the case. Unfortunately, that's not what the safety net really is. It's focused on providing a very small number of farmers growing a small number of commodities assistance just because they don't meet revenue targets. And it's usually the wealthiest farmers that are getting this money. Most farmers don't even get these subsidies, and they certainly the focus is not on crop losses.
Let's turn back to this because you just made this point, but I think it's worth mentioning again. People hear safety net, they think major damage, major crop losses. We're just helping out these farmers so they could stay in business. You're saying that the way that this operates is basically just taking all economic risk out of the equation, and if they don't meet a revenue target, they get some money from the taxpayer.
Yeah, you know, federal policy has become insulting to farmers. You know, the mom-and-pop shop around the corner can manage the ordinary business risk of running a business. But for some reason, when it comes to farmers, Congress doesn't think that farmers are capable of doing so. Well, granted, most farmers are, and that because they don't get these subsidies. But for these kind of this small number of cronies, they're getting assistance just because they don't meet these are revenue targets of a given year. It's just they get less revenue than they thought. But when it comes to like the crop losses and the disasters, that's not what their focus is. Plus, you could have a bumper crop if you're a farmer. The weather could be perfect. The production could be awesome, historical records, and you're still getting a check from the government. And by government, I mean taxpayers.
Right. Taxpayers are footing the bill. We are talking to Darren Baxt, Research Fellow in Agricultural Policy at the Heritage Foundation. And I want to go back to a point you also just made that some people might think this is a safety net for all farmers, but you say that some of this money is – or most of this money is really going to farmers in a very small segment of the overall farming population.
Right. So if we look at about 10% of the farms are getting about 75% or so of the commodity payments and also the crop insurance indemnities. So the Congressional Research Service – there's all kinds of data here, so I might overdata you here. But the Congressional Research Service – just issued a report and looked at the farm program support and said that 94% of that support is going to just six commodities, and that includes rice and corn and soybeans, kind of the row crops. And, you know, some ag producers would say, well, but that's where all the ag production is coming from. Well, actually, all that support is really only going to 28% of the ag production. So another way of putting it is commodities – that are connected to about 3/4 or 75% of all the ag production get about 6% of the farm program support. In other words, most farmers and most agriculture is not getting the subsidies. It's not really an agriculture safety net or a farmer safety net. It's really kind of a crony safety net for a select number of farmers.
And these, I suspect, are the farmers that somewhere along the line found a way to get on the gravy train while the rest of their colleagues are in business like everyone else.
Yeah, you know, farmers kind of pride themselves on being really independent and, you know, the belief in freedom. And for a lot of farmers, that's the case. But, you know, they always want to create an exception when it comes to subsidies. And yes, for corn and rice, soybeans, certain farmers have been able to kind of take advantage of the system. Now, in the 30s and the 40s, you know, there's different conditions that existed. You actually had – some of these programs existed in large part to be a social welfare program to actually help not just with market issues, but also because farm households were making half of what non-farm households were making. Well, things have definitely changed since then. In fact, it's really the opposite now. Farm households make – the median income is about 50% greater than the households for all U.S. households. Their wealth – median wealth of farm households is about 10 times greater compared to all U.S. households. So you've got this reverse Robin Hood effect where taxpayers are handing all this money primarily to these very wealthy farm households and to manage the same risk that anybody else, any business manages, and you'd want a business to manage. And it's pretty hard to defend, and that's what we're trying to go after in the next farm bill.
You mentioned that this is in the farm bill, and so you're not just raising these issues to make people mad. You hope that there will be an impact on policy. What's the goal here?
First of all, I do hope they're mad. The second thing is, look, the House and Senate and Agriculture Committees are going to be not trying to reduce these subsidies. They're going to try to expand them as usual. I think when people are listening to this may think, oh, it's the farm bill. I'm not a farmer. It doesn't impact me. But it does impact you. First of all, we all eat. But besides that, these subsidies distort the decisions made by farmers. So instead of responding to the market, the farmers are going to plant based on the subsidies. So they'll make planting decisions based on the subsidies. Certain programs, like the federal sugar program, drive up prices for consumers. So you're paying higher food prices as a result of these programs. So there's a lot of reasons for a lot of folks to be concerned about this, on top, of course, of the fact that we're paying $15 billion a year to kind of help a bunch of cronies.
These farm bills crop up every 5-6 years or so. Is there any sense, as you're watching this, that people are getting the message and thinking, we got to do something about this?
Yeah. You know, one thing that Heritage Foundation tried to do is try to get ahead of the curve a little this time around. I think in the past, we tend to respond to the legislation that's been introduced by the ag committees. And at that point, I think it's a little too late. So we definitely tried to help shape the message before this farm bill comes around. And we're also working with groups on the left and the right to try to develop a broader coalition. Because believe it or not, folks on the left and the right agree that this farm subsidy system is out of control. And we're trying to at least bring some common sense to it.
In the brief time that we have left, do you think there will be a better farm bill because of this discussion?
Well, I won't lie. It's an uphill battle. But I think that there will be. There will be some changes. We're not going to see everything overnight. But I'm hoping that we can at least move the ball forward. And I think that's all we can really hope for at this point, given how entrenched these agricultural special interests are. But if we can kind of keep the ball moving forward and keep shaping the dialogue, we're doing well.
Well, one person who's going to be watching very closely and raising concerns as these ag committees try to beef up their bills and take more money from the taxpayers is Darren Baxt. He is research fellow in agricultural policy at the Heritage Foundation. Darren, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue, more visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read, a new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Well, it may feel like we just finished an election, but actually the 2018 contests are now only a few months away, with the primary scheduled for May 8th, the general for November 6th. Now, with the candidate filing period having closed, we now have a good sense of how the races for the North Carolina General Assembly have shaped up. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation, and she has been following the filings and is here to give us some of the highlights. Becky, welcome back.
Thank you.
One of the most fascinating things about this is that every single district, all 170, all 170 seats in the General Assembly actually have candidates who are going to be running.
Republican and Democrat in every single one. This is the first time it's ever happened. They started keeping records of this in 1925. So we're not sure if it happened before 1925. We don't have any records of it. We know it hasn't happened since then. Just phenomenal. And as you said, that's one of the most fascinating stories here. And I tell you, real kudos go to the head of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party for finding these people, recruiting these candidates. But there's also been a tremendous amount of work done at the district level and the county level, the local level. So, I mean, kudos to these folks who have gotten out and really gotten people interested and filled all these seats. I think it's phenomenal. I'm really looking forward to this. Really, it's going to be a dynamic, exciting, kind of raucous election cycle. I can't wait.
It really filled with energy. There's been a lot of talk and even some polling already done about which side is more energized to get out and vote. And this seems to indicate both sides.
It sure does. And I think, and that's, you know who wins in this? You know who the real winners are going to be? It's us, the voters, because we're going to have choices. We're going to have a lot of discussion, really know what these people are running for and what the different sides represent. In addition, Donna, in addition to all these candidates that we have on the Republican and Democrat side, we also have more libertarians than ever running. Now, there's not one in every single race, but there are more than we've ever had before. So again, another voice, other ideas being discussed.
So it seems like people are really going to have choices across the ideological spectrum.
Exactly.
In these districts to really be able to choose what it is they want to see in their state legislature, what policies and ideas advanced.
Right. And, you know, of course, what we're hoping for it as a think tank and people who really like ideas and a lot of discussion, that's hopefully what we're going to have, a lot of town halls, a lot of discussion within these districts, a lot of back and forth so that we really see what the different candidates, what the different parties, what the different ideas are that are out there. And I think, again, the voters are going to be the winners in this.
Do we know if all of these races are going to be really competitive?
A lot of them probably not. You know, some of them, and we've heard a lot about gerrymandering and the redistricting and, you know, a lot of confusion leading up to this. In some of them, there are very strong Republican districts, but there is a Democrat running and vice versa. Where I think the real value is no matter who wins the race, is that there's another voice in the race. You know, in 2016, Donna, 44 House seats were already won at the close of filing, 13 Senate seats. So there was no competition at all. There was no alternative voice. And again, 44 House seats, 13 Senate seats in the last go-round that we had. So what we have now, we're going to at least have, if it's a strong, let's just say, you know, Democrat district with a long-standing popular incumbent in that district, their opponent probably is not going to win, but that incumbent is going to have to answer some questions. There's going to be, you know, somebody's going to be challenging their record, asking them questions. There's going to be another voice that's going to be heard, bringing some other ideas to those voters. How those voters ultimately decide, we'll see. But I think that's the real value of this.
Becky, as you've taken a look at the list of candidates, there are a number of names that have popped out. And the top of the list is a gentleman named Bob Rucho.
Now, that sounds familiar.
Why would Bob Rucho sound familiar? And looks like he's running.
Well, he is. And this is kind of interesting. One of the things that we've seen with the changes in the districts and the court cases and the redistricting cases, there was so much confusion, Donna, that for this election cycle, they have waived the requirement that a candidate has to live in the district for a year. That's been the rule in all these other elections. But again, because there's been so much confusion, they've waived that. So Bob Rucho served in the Senate. You may remember him. He was sort of the architect of the tax reforms of 2013.
Very powerful, very influential.
Very, very loud, very very, very well large known. Megaphone, shall we say. And full disclosure, Bob Rucho is a friend. He represented the Senate in a district in the Matthews-Pineville area. There is a new open district in the Iredale County, Lake Norman area. And so Bob Rucho saw this opportunity. He, believes, rented an apartment in Lake Norman and has filed to run for this district. So he, same Bob Rucho, different district, different set of voters. So we'll see what happens.
He's obviously decided he doesn't think he's done yet making policy in North Carolina. Yeah. And obviously he would have to win that race to get back in.
But we're going to be here. Believe me, we will be hearing from Bob Rucho in that district and hearing some ideas. And the voters in that district, I think, are going to, you know, have a good idea of what he would bring to the table and whether or not they want him to represent them.
So he popped out on the list, but Becky, the interesting thing is that if you look at the list of candidate filings, there are a number of names that are not on the list anymore. We have some folks who are retiring, a couple of pretty well-known people.
We do, and two most noteworthy, Representative Mickey Michaud, who has represented the Durham area. Donna, he has served in the North Carolina General Assembly for 44 years.
Incredible.
I mean, just unbelievable. You know, what he's seen, what he's participated in. And Mickey Michaud is also one who has been in leadership positions. He was the chairman of the Appropriations Committee for a
Democrat.
Number of years. A Democrat, yes. Also very active in the legislative Black Caucus leadership position there. So it's a real loss to the General Assembly, you know, with everything that he has done and brought in his leadership over the years. And then another one, long-serving, also tremendous contributions, John Blust, who has represented the Greensboro district and has not been there quite as long as Representative Michaud has been, but has been there for quite some time. So those are two of the oldest serving. And we have this turnover, this churn every 2 years where there are a group of legislators who always retire. There are some who always choose not to serve again. This is not unusual. I don't think that there are any more legislators retiring this go-round, but it's particularly noteworthy with these two. And then there's others. Chad Barefoot from Wake County is retiring. Some folks from the Mecklenburg County, some changes there. Beverly Earle, Angela Bryant from the northeastern part of the state. So, you know, we're seeing some changes. We will miss those who have served and served admirably, but we are certainly welcoming new faces and
new
fresh
faces,
new ideas.
New,
you know, this is all good.
Exactly. So the voters will have very interesting options in those areas where those long-serving members are now retiring. Ultimately, Becky, this is a political contest, of course. And so right now the Republicans have super majorities in both the North Carolina House and the North Carolina Senate, puts them in a very influential position. The Democrats, however, have been very strong in their campaign, saying they're going to break those super majorities. Ultimately, how could this shake out? With Republicans in control or Democrats perhaps getting back some power?
You know, a lot can happen between now and November. We don't know what's going to happen. Part of this is money that's raised. I know that the leadership in both the House and the Senate, both parties are out raising money to support these candidates, to get messages out. You know, another thing that a lot of people are talking about, what is the Trump effect going to be? How is the things that are happening in Washington, how is that going to affect these North Carolina legislative races? And, you know, you're already seeing the Trump factor where some Republicans are attaching themselves to some of the Trump ideas. Some of the Democrats are trying to tie candidates to Trump's apron strings. So it's going to be a really interesting next several months.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation. That's all the time we have for the show. Thanks for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.